It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning. Happy Saturday, everybody. Welcome to Legal Defense. I'm joined once again by my good friend and colleague, Attorney John Birdsall. John, how are you?
How are you doing, Kirk? I'm doing great.
I'm awesome.
I'm loving that. You're always awesome, dude. Loving the nice weather, finally. I mean, it's a little rainy this last week.
But it got nice and humid and warm this week.
Yeah, you know, I mean, better than the alternative, buddy.
Better than the alternative. You know, it was funny because the other day it got cold again, like cold as in the mid-50s, and I thought, well, that was summer. It's gone. Goodbye. But anyway, hey, I wanted to talk about some fan mail that we got.
Oh, yeah.
And I won't mention names because people like to remain anonymous in these situations, but a fella that listens to our show said, you know, really loves it and is an avid listener, listens every Saturday, and really respects what we do. But he had a personal experience to share, and apparently his son, who is a later age teenager, is what I'm gathering from the email, was riding his bike. It was dark out, but I don't believe curfew. And his headlamp on his bicycle was apparently either not fully illuminated or was, you know, not was going in and out, something like that.
That was my shock. Sign.
Yeah, I know. Crime of the century. Call in the SWAT team. But the police squad that was, patrolling the area decided, hey, we got a perp. And they, detained him. And normally, you know, okay, if the police see something like that and there's a kid riding around on a bicycle without a required headlamp, and I believe you can have one attached to your helmet or something too, or you can hold it in your hand. You can have a flashlight in your hand, and mm-hmm. I think that still complies. But the point is, you know, you could theoretically write a, you know, little citation for $5 fine or whatever the heck that is. But more often than not, the correct thing would be to say, young man, did you realize that your headlamp is not working correctly? Better go get that checked out. And he'd say, yes, thank you, sir. I appreciate your service to our community. Well, no, it didn't go that way. What happened was they basically jacked him up, sent him down Shakedown Street, like Grateful Dead fans would say. And They emptied his knapsack, had him empty his pockets. They basically did a full-blown, slightly short of, you know, cavity search of this kid. And they didn't find anything, of course. And he's, you know, they say, okay, sorry about all that. And they sent him on his way. And, of course, his dad is quite upset by this. And
was there any attempt to gain consent from the boy?
Well, no. I doubt it. Right. Well, if there was, the typical scenario that we see is that I'm going to search your pockets, turn them inside out, or else I can get a warrant. You know, that's like kind of how they get their consent.
So, okay, yeah.
Do what I say or...
But we don't know what precisely happened with this particular...
Right, I don't. Okay, I don't know what precisely happened, but I can tell from the context that it's one of these typical situations.
Oh, no doubt about it. Yeah, no doubt about it.
You know, to gain the upper psychological hand. And I say this all the time. I'm going to say it again. If we all knew our rights, which are very simple, you know, they're explained in the Bill of Rights, and then everything that's in the Federal Bill of Rights is repeated in our own state constitution in some way, shape, or form. In fact, we have greater constitutional protections under state constitutional law than we do under federal law.
That's true.
And things are supposed to be worded simply and put forth so that they have very basic concepts. And they're there always, never to be modified is the idea. So the basic human and citizen right that we have to be free from an unreasonable search and seizure is just that. It's that simple. And if you know that you're right, the law also requires, because of the case law that has developed over the years, that somebody invoke that right. And it's up to that individual's responsibility to realize They have the right.
So what does that require? It's a one-word answer to this.
It requires having the guts to say...
It requires courage.
By the way, officer, the Fourth Amendment says that I have the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. That's the problem right there,
having the courage
with the police.
Honestly, let's talk about you and I, Kirk, because you and I have dealt with the system for, 25-plus years, dealt with... every form of police officer, FBI agent, Homeland Security, ICE, whatever it is. And so we're well familiar with it. Honestly, if we got stopped and somebody was hassling us, we'd still have to summon the courage. And we deal with this every day. Would you agree with that? Or would you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I put myself in that situation all the time. And
it's
you're driving down the road,
it's a very intimidating situation.
It is. If you're driving down the road and the cop pulls you over for whatever reason, and then he says, "Can I look in your trunk?" The right answer is no, even if there's nothing in your trunk. But you're tempted. We're all tempted.
Sure,
even
go ahead. No problem.
Sophisticated lawyers like us, would be tempted to say, "Go ahead," just because you don't want to act like you're causing a hassle. And it's true. I think that we've evolved to the point where the police get compliance from so many people, the vast majority of people they encounter, that the exercising of one's rights becomes suspicious.
Yeah, presumptive guilt becomes presumptive guilt.
And I guess the best way I've heard it worded, and this comes from – I can't remember where I heard this, but this is, I think, the best way that one can invoke their rights is that I do not consent to searches. Like, in general. Like, never.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
And
I like that a lot.
It's a good way to put it. Like, I don't – today, I'm worried about what's in my trunk, so I'm not going to consent to a search. No, you don't do that. You don't say that. You say, I do not consent to searches, just like my constitutional rights allow me to not consent to
searches. Right, yeah. And I say that with all due respect, officer, and, I understand you're doing your job, but that's just my policy. So thank you, though.
Hey, there was a video going around YouTube. This was about 6 months ago, and I found it fascinating, one, because it was brilliant, and two, because I'm not sure that it would really work this way. But we don't have checkpoints in our state. There are efforts to create them all the time. But in a lot of states, I think Pennsylvania is one of them. New York, I know, is one of them. They have these sobriety checkpoints. And I think Wisconsin has always been leery of the constitutional implications of that because – We, as a general constitutional principle, avoid what we call general searches or suspicionless searches. And a roadblock, at least in my mind, sure enough, seems suspicionless because there's really no...
Of course they're
stopping everybody.
By definition.
They're stopping everybody. But in those states that have them, all the litigation that has surrounded whether they're allowed or not has supported, the ability for the police to do that. But there was a video of this kid that he had a handwritten note that said, "I do not consent to searches. I will not roll my window down because that would constitute a search. If you intend to arrest me, do so immediately. Otherwise, allow me on my way." So he tapes it, to the outside of his window as he drives up to the checkpoint. And then he videotapes with his iPhone or whatever what the cop's reaction is.
Who was doing
this?
And
the first cop – it's a kid. Yeah,
it's
I think
a kid?
You can still find it on YouTube. I don't know if he's a kid. He seems like a college-age type kid.
Oh, well, that's – so that's awesome.
Yeah, college-ish. So he comes up to the checkpoint and the cop comes up and he's reading it. And then he doesn't know what to make of it. And he calls another cop over. And then the other cop reads it. And they kind of scratch their chins. And you can see the guy talking to his whisper mic. And he's getting a hold of his supervisor or something like that. And then they just kind of shrug and say, "Okay, go ahead." They wave him on. And then he never had to roll down his window. I mean, that took some guts.
you know what? That was awesome. And I really, honestly, I really, really like that that idea, Kirk, about just sort of a general. This is my policy. It might be your policy to ask every time, but it's my policy to say politely no, and that's fine.
Well, that reminds me of a a debate I always have with prosecutors, because our listeners might not realize this, but they always want us to waive our clients' preliminary hearings, because you can have one or you can.
You and I are of the same mind on this one. Go ahead. Go ahead. I know exactly what you're going to say.
They'll say something like, you know, our policy is we'll recommend something or other if you waive the preliminary hearing. And, you know, sometimes they'll say this right when you're arriving at court. And I say, I'm sorry. My policy is that you need to submit an offer in writing that I need to accept in writing in order to waive any such preliminary hearing. And you violated my policy. Sorry about that.
This is something similar happened to me on a case where
we got to take a break. Now, but let's do that right when we come back. So we'll be back right after these messages. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
And we're back. We hope you enjoyed those very informative and hopefully encouraging messages so that you buy whatever thing or service was being advertised.
I bought everything online. I couldn't help myself. But
hey, Memorial Day is coming up in just a couple days. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Awesome in the sense that it's one of those holidays that I really appreciate, because I think it's very appropriate. Well, that, but also I think it's appropriate that we have a day in our country where we remember, all get together and remember everybody who sacrificed their lives mm-hmm. for our freedom. I mean, that's
a big deal.
I think we should have more than one day, but it's good to have a day where that's
well, we have
the
Veterans
thing we
day.
Think about. So. Yeah, well, Veterans Day is about veterans, not people that died necessarily.
Well,
so.
That's true. It's, yes, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know anyway, what? If you have too many, then it takes the specialness away. You know?
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
So what I was saying before the break was I had something similar happen to me in terms of this. You know, we have this rule. So I had this client who hired me because his prior lawyers were trying to push him into a plea, and he knew that if he came to me that, you know, I would take him to the promised land if that's where he wanted to go. So we're getting ready for trial on a very difficult, complicated case. And typically a judge will ask, well, did you make a pretrial offer? And if so, do you reject it? That sort of thing. And some judges do, some judges don't. Well, the DA walks up to me and she throws this piece of paper at me and she goes, this is a letter with the offer. You have to sign it and your client has to sign it. That's what we do in this county. And then we put it in an envelope and we keep it there for appeal. And I go, I just looked at her as politely as I possibly could. And I said, thank you very, very much. I will look at it, but I don't think I'm going to have my client sign anything. And then we went on the record, and I said to the judge, and the judge was clearly like confused what to do because he's so used to doing this, because that's what they do up there, mm-hmm. that he's like, well, that's okay. We don't have to do it.
Yeah. Well, said it's not your policy to do that. Basically,
it's my policy to not have my clients sign anything.
I know
or make
several
any
judges. I know several judges, particularly in Brown County, that like to require that.
That you sign something with the offer.
Yeah, which is crazy, but
yeah,
I mean, because they're not supposed to know what the offer was, and they seal it and they put it in there and that kind of thing. Well, and I think the idea is that they're trying to memorialize what discussions were had in case the defendant comes back and says, the lawyer never told me about this or something like that.
Well,
which is silly because it's a matter of attorney-client privilege anyway. You know, the fact that somebody is rejecting a plea and what the plea offer was, I mean, I think that's completely irrelevant to anything.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, they're trying to cut off an ineffective claim later on, you know, ineffective assistance to counsel, so...
Which is dumb because if someone's ineffective, they should be found ineffective. There's prosecutor's job is to try and
That's an excellent point. That's an excellent point. Hey, can we talk about this Hague interrogation thing that I mentioned earlier to
you? Let's do that.
So this is like a subject that's near and dear to my heart. And the reason that it's so near and dear, not just because I'm a defense attorney, but because I had this very exceptional false confession case, which, frankly, I should have been called by 60 Minutes to talk about. but maybe because it's happened in Milwaukee. But
if 60 Minutes is listening, they probably will.
You know what? If any producers from 60 Minutes, please, you need to broadcast about this case because I'll just give you a very brief thing on the facts. It was a 18-year-old kid, IQ of 70. The cops knew that. They took advantage of them. They manipulated him over a period of 3 days while he's in custody to get him to confess to a homicide he didn't commit. Spent 13 months in custody. He was found incompetent to proceed for the longest time until a judge finally heard my Miranda issue shortly before trial, and she kicked the case. So what they used is what you are very familiar with, was just something, it was a version of the Reed technique, which is a confrontation guilt presumptive process. That really is has produced over the years a troubling number of false confessions, and we could tick them off across the country. The Central Park Five, you know, just any number of cases across the country, including the one I just mentioned that was my case, this has been fascinating to me because this is something that people, some law enforcement agencies are turning away from, like in Los Angeles, in Philadelphia,
absolutely.
A couple of others.
I know for a fact that many law enforcement agencies are disavowing portions of the Reed technique. I've got the Reed manual on my bookshelf, and if you want to get a little chuckle out of it, open this. It's ridiculous how, the idea go ahead.
It was the Bible since the 40s,
Oh, yeah.
Well, now what they're replacing with it, if there was a fairly positive thing that came out of the Iraq War and the CIA black prison sites and all of the enhanced interrogation techniques, it's that there was a rebellion against those techniques within the law enforcement and the intelligence communities, and they developed what's something called the HIG technique, which is High Value Detainee Interrogation Group, and it was a reaction to Abu Ghraib and all of the abusive, coercive interrogation techniques there. And it's basically an idea of it takes away the guilt presumption and it turns it into a conversational rapport building exercise to allow the person to talk. It's something that really, if you just come in at somebody and just are in their face and it's confrontational, a lot of people just clam up and it produces tunnel vision in the police officer. But here, all you have to do is be patient and people talk, and they shouldn't, because as we said, we need to invoke your rights. But, if you and I are advising them, we're saying, no, of course you're not talking, period. End of conversation. Take five.
Well, it's an interesting point because more and more nowadays I find that a very effective technique of demonstrating the reason why my client may have said something in such an interrogational setting is to play the interrogation video. And
absolutely.
People are shocked. People are really shocked when they see what typically happens in an interrogation room, because it's tunnel vision is understating it. I mean, the goal is to get a confession word for word.
Well,
I think
the world,
the officer imagines that it happened.
The world finally got a glimpse of that with Making a Murderer, and they watched this poor Brendan Dassey being manipulated by these obviously very experienced police officers. And
that case is still winding its way through the habeas petition. I mean, I've been following it. It's very interesting.
Yeah, where's it at?
It's
process?
In briefing right now. It's in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, in the Milwaukee Division, and I believe Judge Duffin has it right now.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's
who's representing him?
In briefing. It's in it is a lawyer from Illinois.
Oh, is it that woman? That woman that's also representing, and her name escapes me, is Catherine something.
Yeah. Yes, that's her.
Okay, yeah. Apparently she's gotten 17 exonerations. And you know what? You know what her specialty is? Medical malpractice.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, I saw that. Because I've been following it just because it's very interesting. Plus, I do quite a bit of habeas work just because I find it fascinating. But Anyway, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just saying she's, I don't know much about her other than, you know, looking on her website and I have to believe that both Avery and Dassey probably consulted Jerry and Dean, their original attorneys, or at least Avery's original attorneys, and got, you know, some sort of referral, because I'm sure she's doing it pro bono. I mean, they don't have any money.
Yeah, I believe that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
It must be.
And, you know, I was kind of thinking that the Innocence Project might take up his case, but apparently not. I don't know.
Well, I don't think the Innocence Project is equipped to handle a habeas petition on an ineffective assistance claim, because it's very complex.
Yeah.
And not only that, but, you know, there are very quick turnaround times in a habeas case. You've got to be on the ball. You can't rely on law students to, you know, necessarily have the continuity. Yeah, in the...
That's an excellent point. If you've been following Dassey, have you been following Avery at all? I mean, I know that...
No, I haven't, because I think that was an entirely different...
it is.
No, well, no, he filed his own appeal without representation. That's what happened with him. And then I think that got shot down. I'm not sure that's going anywhere other than...
I thought they had a new evidence claim of some sort.
Yeah, there is a new evidence claim. That's the only thing that's left on that. But this Dassey case is very, very detailed into all the things that we saw on Making
So
Murder.
Many.
Plus some. I mean, it's really kind of fascinating how it all works. Hey, time for another break, but we'll be right back in just a few moments. Please stay tuned.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
And we're back with more Legal Defense. You thought maybe you were rid of us, but you're not. You can always turn the radio off, but don't do that.
No.
John, I want to let you talk more about your high-value, intensive interrogation type thing that you were talking about. So
right.
Feel free.
Yeah, so... I think most folks, I'll call them civilians, that aren't in the criminal justice system or don't work within or around it, assume that when they read in the paper, well, the police talked to this guy and the guy confessed. And, you know, that's how the report reads, too. And that's certainly how the newspaper article reads. They don't appreciate what goes into that or the way that police put either thoughts in your head or words in your mouth. By this kind of guilt presumptive driven process that they use routinely. At least every department that I've ever experienced has used this. I haven't seen anything in Wisconsin, anybody in Wisconsin changing away from this read technique sort of strategy. But I'm encouraged. I'm very encouraged because I'm encouraged that many departments are, like large departments. And because you know, as you know, Kirk, I mean, we didn't just get here overnight. The war on drugs and really the war on crime in particular, even really before the war on drugs started in the 70s, there was encouragement from the courts of appeals, the Supreme Court, to allow officers, to allow law enforcement to do a lot more as we go along. And we'll allow more searches. We're going to allow more interrogation. We're going to allow more of this and more of that. And we're just going to keep, you know, there's more exceptions to the mandates of the Fourth and Fifth Amendments. You know what I'm saying? So, and so I think it's a shock to people to see, you know, how the sausage is made. How those statements that they read
sure
in the paper.
I'm sure that that's where this is coming from, is the fact that, as I was alluding to before, excuse me, the general public, when they see how an actual read technique interrogation occurs, are frankly horrified. And I think that there's been some sensitivity to that, thankfully, to the advent of documentation in the form of video. And video is much better than audio, by the way, because
absolutely.
Video, you get to see, you know, the actual body language,
get to see the expressions, you know, on their faces,
the aggression. It's almost like following a map when they're doing the read technique, which includes at the point where the confrontation begins, the chair moves closer, there's no escape route, you know, that kind of thing in the interview room. But I bet you a dozen donuts even a baker's dozen, that this is in response to the fact that more often we're seeing the actual interrogation process presented to jurors and publicly available because of our ability to document. And the thing that is so crazy, especially when you talk to a veteran litigator like you, remember the old days, which was not that long ago.
Bad old days, when, you mean?
Yeah, the bad old days. When the police could characterize a confession however they wished, and it was up to your client, who said it didn't happen that way, to somehow have a credibility battle with the guy on the stand who's wearing a uniform and a badge. No. I mean, that just doesn't work. You know?
Here's the thing. You said that the public was horrified by this, and I think they are, rightly. But my worry is that they're going to get over their horrifiedness. Like, for example, Donald Trump is the nominee of the Republican Party officially now, as of this week. And I don't know if you knew that, if you followed that news bit. But the point is that people have been horrified at his candidacy, and now 85% of Republicans are backing him, even if they're holding their nose. So our ability to be horrified is easily overcome as long as the general drift is that we love cops and we love what they do. All right, so this is horrifying. But you know what?
If you're waiting around in the sewer, eventually it doesn't seem to smell as bad, right?
That's what you're saying. I think that's a fair characterization, Kirk. That's a fair, yeah. And so you and I have been in the sewer for so long that to us it smells normal, you know. And so we're still horrified by it.
Is the GOP going to kick in to get him a new toupee, or is he going to have to wear that same old rug that he's had?
He says it's his hair. I saw him in a speech once, and he pulled it pretty convincingly.
I saw that as well. But you know what it is? It is technically his hair, but it's been sewn on.
Oh, is it one of those?
It's one of those, and it's so they did kind of a botched job because it was way too low on his forehead, and that's why it looks so weird.
I can't get over the orange. Know, it's just orange.
I don't know.
So I feel like I'm at the zoo or something, but anyways.
Yeah. a Trumpangatang, you know, whatever you want to call it. But hey, I wanted to talk about one other thing in terms of unfairness and how the government works. And quite surprisingly, our United States Supreme Court issued a very significant decision earlier this week that, you know, this never happens, but they reversed a death penalty case on the merits, meaning due to a legal claim that they found to be correct made by the defense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's rare enough that they'll, you know, reverse a death penalty sentence. But it's usually because of something having to do with the sentencing structure or the way that, like, you know, just last week we were talking about the Florida case where it had to do with their scheme and the fact that their jury participation and all that other stuff, just in general, you know, like that part of how they implement the death penalty is unconstitutional. This was a specific case that was very fact specific, which almost always spells doom for those who are trying to get relief from the Supreme Court. Because the Supreme Court's not going to weigh in on a case that only affects one person, rarely. I mean, that's just not what their function is. It's a discretionary court of appeal, meaning that they can say no, they're not even going to look at it if they don't think it's significant enough or applies to cases across the nation. But the real interesting thing about this case is that it has to do with a death penalty prosecution that resulted in the imposition, although the person has not been executed yet, of the death penalty. And there's a case called Batson versus Kentucky that goes back to quite a while ago.
1986.
There you go. I knew it was in the 80s. That relates to a person cannot be deprived of, you know, basically the right to have a jury that is non-discriminatory. Now, a lot of people misunderstand what a jury of your peers means. So let's say you're African American. That doesn't mean you get, you know, 12 African Americans on your jury. It doesn't mean that. But what it does mean is that in terms of what Batson holds is that the prosecution can't deliberately preclude people that are of the same race or protected class that you're in as part of your jury.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
And this, and then there was a case years later that said the defense can't do that either, which is kind of weird. But anyway, I don't know why. Because, you know, the rules are not supposed to be the same. It's not like we're not playing by the same rules. We have, as the defense, we have greater protections. You know?
In theory.
But anyway.
In theory.
The thing that's shocking about this case is that, as you said, since 1986, Batson has been the rule, and prosecutors may not exercise peremptory challenges. Oh, gosh, I guess we got to explain that, too. So there are challenges for cause when trying to get rid of a juror because you say this person cannot be fair or impartial.
But or the person themselves trial, say that.
Or the person themselves say that.
Right.
And then the court would strike that person, replace that potential juror with a new juror that is part of the pool, and then the questioning continues to select the jury. But after challenges for cause are exhausted or, you know, after they've been discussed, there are always peremptory strikes, which peremptory means you don't have to give a reason. And you basically don't say why you're striking the person, but both sides get a certain number of peremptory strikes. It all depends on what kind of case it is and so on. But when exercising a peremptory strike, let's say it's a black defendant, and the prosecution goes to strike a black juror. Based on Batson, they're supposed to state a race-neutral reason for that strike. Okay? So here's the fascinating thing about this case. Somehow, and I don't know how, it became part of the court record, the notes that the prosecutors took in the process of trying to decide what jurors they wanted. And believe it or not, they identified the ones that were black, and they like said, no, this person's black. We don't want that.
Can we back up for just 1 minute here?
Because
I think what would add to the discussion here, and tell me if we're running on time.
Hold on. Yeah. We got to take a break. But
okay.
Hold that thought, because we're going to jump right back into it in just a few seconds. Okay. Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. John, I interrupted you because our sponsors had to say something to our listeners.
Right.
They're entitled to do. I mean, they pay money to have these advertisements.
And, you know, they have awesome products, and I...
That's the way the world works.
Once again, got carried away, and I bought everything during the commercial, so a little embarrassed.
I know.
About
hey,
that.
Remember back how commercials used to be where, well, who was the guy? Fred Harvey, or what's that? Is that his name?
Fred Harvey, yeah.
Yeah, where he'd say, you know, folks, I use Brill Cream on my hair, which is why it looks so brilliant. You should do the same.
You know what?
Those were commercials back then.
Yeah. It's true. Value hardware stores. And now you know the rest of the story.
Exactly.
I remember all of that. Yep. So, anyways, get back on track. What you were talking about was, correctly, you were talking about the new case. It's Foster versus Chapman, and then you were getting back to the original source of this with Batson from 1986. Well, correctly, you note that this is supposed to eliminate race-based decisions in jury selection. And what I wanted to just interject with was a long history, and we won't cite every single case, but there's a case after case after case over the 30, 40 years after Batson, where people would come with complaints about prosecutors racially selecting juries, and the prosecutors would come back with the excuse, well, no, I just didn't like his hair. Or it was, they kind of looked at us funny, or they were a secretary or a bus driver or a lawyer or whatever. They would just literally make something up.
The most common, the they're trained. I know this, and I hate to admit it, but I went to the Attorney General's Institute in Washington, D.C., back when they had training in Washington, D.C. Now mm-hmm. it's in South Carolina, for anybody in the Department of Justice, because I was a special assistant United States attorney for about 3 years. And the way that they trained you was you need to state something that's race neutral, but also make sure that it's something that they can't dispute on the record, such as the person appeared fidgety or nervous. You know, you cannot dispute that at later because the transcript's not going to show
right
one right. way or the other.
And that was the problem with all these cases that came before the court time after time after time. They basically allowed the prosecutors, even though they had Batson and they elicited this rule, but they didn't enforce the rule. And so now we finally come up on this latest case, Foster, and they were mm-hmm. they were faced with, I remember when this case first, you know, came up for oral arguments, and the
right.
the unbelievable facts here. I mean, this is like
yeah.
if you're a defense attorney, it's like, you know, a Christmas present gift wrapped of evidentiary bonanza, you know? I mean, it's just...
Well, just proof of what we see all the time, but the general public doesn't. You know, the people don't believe that there's this kind of manipulation that occurs in the system.
So
but
let's read for the jurors what was actually there. Okay, so this is what was in the prosecutor's file. Copies of the jury list on which each name of the black prospective juror were highlighted in bright green, and then there was a legend where it said that bright green, quote, represents blacks. There was an affidavit from an investigator that compared black jurors and concluded that if it comes down to having to pick one of the black jurors, quote, this one might be okay. There were notes identifying black jurors as B1, B2, B3. There was notes with N, which stands for, which appeared next to the name of each black juror. It stood for no, not for something else. A list that titled "Definite No's" containing sick names, including all the qualified black jurors. Let's see. There was a notes with on the Church of Christ that was annotated with no black church.
Right, and there was a white person that was indicated no because they attend a church that's predominantly black. I remember that. Yeah.
So
I mean,
that was like. I mean, when I saw that coming up, I said, I don't know how they don't. But you know what? I predicted that they would deny this, that they would find for
well,
the government.
You know,
and I was wrong.
The emperor. This is a case where the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah,
I mean, you
clearly.
Simply cannot pretend too much.
Oh, I don't know. Justice Alito, he concurred, but he said that Georgia's res judicata doctrine was still in play, and Justice Thomas dissented.
Oh,
so
well, you know, Thomas is so conservative; it's ridiculous. But let me just say this.
Yeah.
The thing that people would find surprising about this is that, you know, this didn't happen that long ago. It's not like this was a case from the 50s. I mean, this is recent history.
Right.
And it's very rare that the court would have access to these prosecutors' notes. I do not know how the procedural history resulted in that becoming part of the record. It must have been some extraordinary defense work in the courts below, because we don't get to see that stuff. You know, we
right.
don't get to see
like
notes
they don't get
the
to
prosecutors
see,
make.
Just a, they don't get to see our work product. You know.
Yeah. Well, and frankly, anything that we do, at least in Wisconsin, having to do with jury selection, we're supposed to give back to the clerk. We're not even supposed to keep names of jurors or anything like that, theoretically. But it's shocking that, number one, this occurred. Number two, somehow the documentation that proves the racial bias survived the process by which it ends up in the hands of the United States Supreme Court. And,
well,
they just
because
simply
of the Supreme Court's
ignore.
Precedence.
Yeah.
Their prior
exactly.
rulings, you know?
Right, exactly. But, you know, that's just so sad that there can be this type of insidious. These are government workers. These are prosecutors that work for the government.
Mm-hmm.
And they're supposed to have really a higher moral standard, a higher ethical calling than the people they're prosecuting, at least, right?
Yeah,
and they always accuse us of...
That's their oath.
Yeah, that's their oath. And we have no... Trust me, if stuff like this happens, it weakens everyone's faith in the system. And how is anybody going to obey any law if they think it's arbitrarily enforced, or if they think people that are going to discriminate against people arbitrarily are going to have control over other people's lives? I mean, this is bad for America, this kind of practice, and rightly so. I don't know if the guy did what he's accused of or convicted of or not, but he deserves to have his conviction reversed. Absolutely. That's the way our system works. And anybody who says otherwise doesn't understand the importance of the integrity of the prosecutorial function. And when we expose things like this, especially when it didn't happen that long ago, like I said before, it should shock you. So, are you still there?
Yeah, it shocks me.
Sorry. I'll get down off my soapbox.
You were on a winder, you know? I mean, it's like, I was actually holding up signs, go Kirk, you know? I mean,
yeah, I'm like sweating now.
I know. I'm like, I'm back in your corner. I'm like, you almost got him. You got him on the ropes, Kirk.
Yeah. Ding, 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 ding.
I'm wiping your brow, you know? I'm like, hit him in the...
Cut my eye.
Hit the body. But you know, that's our role. Is we have to champion these kind of fights, and you need that sort of, frankly, you need that fight. It reminds me of an article when I was a young lawyer. There was an article about legal training in law schools, and it was, the guy titled it something to the effect of, I don't remember exactly, but something to the effect of lawyers, like trial lawyers, need the fight stuff, you know, instead of the right stuff. And because they have to have, I mean, you see lawyers all the time who just never go to trial because they're too lazy and they just plead everybody out. And it's a lot of work, or they just don't know how to do it, you know. But mostly you need the willingness to fight and to tell your client's story,
You know Jim Shelley. I'm sure you know Jim Shelley.
No,
everybody knows Jim Shelley. The one of the most... gutsy lawyers I think has ever existed. I mean, he's right up there with F. Lee Bailey, you know, in terms of his personality and his aggressiveness. And you talk to him about things, how things used to be back in the 60s and the 70s, and every case went to trial. I mean, the normal thing was you take a case to trial.
Yeah, there was a whole group of
lawyers
like that.
And it would be rare that things didn't go to trial.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of reasons for that. But you know what? I say this all the time on the show, but the percentage of cases that are actually tried now is just abysmally low, and that's a bad thing.
Well, I think you and I can be proud to say that we're not in that group.
Nope, we're not. Hey, that's it for this week. So tune in next week to hear more Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear. Hope you've enjoyed the show. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Take care.